Welcome to the Dogs and Deadlifts, Building Better Dogs and People podcast. Join your host, Daniel Rose, as we discuss everything canine and human strength and conditioning. We talk to experts, hear from people in the know, and just talk the latest on strength and conditioning for both people and their pups. We are about building better dogs and people. Are you looking for the perfect gift for you or a friend that loves dogs and fitness? Dogs and Deadlifts has you covered with merchandise and giftware, including t-shirts, hoodies, cushion covers, mugs, plus much more. Head over to teespring.com/dogsanddeadlifts. That's teespring.com/dogsanddeadlifts. Or check out the link in the podcast notes.
So welcome back to the Dogs and Deadlifts podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Rose. And today we have all the way from the USA, Brad Cassing. Hi, Brad.
Hey.
Look, fantastic to have you here. It's been a bit of a journey. I know that we've been sort of speaking on and off for quite some time, but finally got you here, and I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
Look, I suppose, we're going to talk about bike drawing, and in particular bike drawing bikes today. For those listeners out there, can you just give us a bit of an introduction about yourself, how you got started both with bikes and also into the sled dog world?
Well, I'm one of the minority in the United States where I got into bikes long before I got into any of the dog sports. I started racing bikes back in high school, spent 14 years working in shops, at least part-time. And it was only much later, after I'd been biking for a very long time, had a lot of experience with bikes, that I got into bike drawing at all.
Yeah, it's amazing how things work out sometimes, and I know that you're heavily involved with bike drawing, but I see some fantastic stuff you're doing with your dogs in the cliffs or the canyons over there as well.
Yeah, I think you call it canyoning down there in Australia. We call it canyoneering up here. Yeah. And so we do everything with our dogs. So we're rappelling off 250-foot cliffs. Doing it all, 100-mile backpacking trips. Yeah, they go everywhere with us, and that's actually how we got into this. We just wanted an all-around, adventure dog. My wife had some experience with sled dogs when she lived in up north in Minnesota, near the Canadian border. We got a sled dog, this would be just a great, do-it-all kind of dog. We greatly misunderstood how energetic and driven these dogs are. I never believed that bike drawing could actually be a more than just, on leash riding with your dog. Mm-hmm. Only took a few rides before I realized that it was something new, something exciting.
Yeah. I was only just talking about it this morning. And the buzz that I get from, riding with the dogs, going at those speeds, hitting the corners, is like no other dog sport that I've participated in. The buzz that I get, I've done some agility, I've done some protection dog stuff, but, on the bike, behind the dog, hitting those corners is certainly, buzz, I just get that buzz.
Oh, yeah. I look back at my GoPro videos and I'm just giggling all the time. I love it. It's a thrill.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's start. We've got a number of questions that we wanted to go through. We've got some members of the Dogs and Deadlifts community have written in and things like that. But so I wanted to talk about, specifically bikes. In a world at the moment that's a little bit crazy on with bikes. They're either hard to get, we spoke about it online the other day. Crazy inflation. At the moment, before we jump into the nitty gritties. What are you seeing with in regards to bikes at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, bikes have been harder to get. But one kind of positive thing that I've seen from a lot of this is I think a lot of people are, you know, spending more time searching for bikes, trying to find them. Mm-hmm. They're not going out and just buying bikes, you know, without any sort of planning because they're not there. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually finding that suddenly in the last year, people have a lot more awareness of the differences between bikes. They're really spending some time researching and searching for things and really understanding that there are bigger differences than they might have seen a year ago. So on one hand, bikes are harder to get, but I think the appreciation for the differences in bikes and what makes a good bike is growing, which is very good.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. You know, I'll talk about my journey at the moment. You know, I had my bike stolen and, you know, I went into the bike shop and I knew the bike that I wanted to buy. And he's like, no, I can't get it till mid 2022. You know, I'm like, oh, I need a bike now. You know, so I went back and, you know, did my research and whilst not ideal, I've ended up with the I think I mentioned the Trek Marlin 7, you know, to get me through. It's certainly more than capable to do what I want it to do, but you know, definitely at this point in time wasn't my first pick, right? You know,
well, no, I think like a bike, what you've ended up with the Marlin 7, I think that's a fantastic bike, especially for people starting off looking to do, you know, the higher speed bike touring. So I would certainly say bikes like that are very capable if you can find them.
That's exactly right. So, you know, let's sort of dial it back. And, you know, if someone's looking to get into bike drawing, obviously they've got their, you know, their dog, you know, but they're starting to look at, you know, look for a bike, you know, is, you know, the bike in the garage, you know, is that where we start or do we go out and, you know, look for these brand new bikes? Where do we start?
So that question really depends on how much experience the human has, mm-hmm. and how much drive the dog has. Yeah. If you're somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience on bikes, but you've got a bike in the garage that you take out a few times a year, you've got a slower dog that just wants to kind of trot ahead, sometimes pull, sometimes loosen up a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, that older, you know, basic bike in the garage, will actually do pretty well. Mm-hmm. The cheaper, older bikes are actually generally pretty okay to handle on flat ground and on, you know, on cement and at lower speeds. They're designed to be bikes for inexperienced people where somebody can kind of get on balance much more easily right off the bat. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you get a dog that you're just kind of curious if your dog's into it, you're not looking to go high speeds, I'd say absolutely give it a try before you go out and make a commitment to a really nice bike. So yeah, absolutely, I would say give it a go on a bike like that, but be aware that the cheaper department store bikes, older bikes, mm-hmm. They are not stable at higher speeds, and they are unsafe to ride on rough off-road terrain.
Yeah. So I, you know, correct me if you have a different opinion, but, you know, I sort of place, you know, once I've, you know, I've given it a go from, you know, the bike that I've had for, you know, since forever, you know, then I sort of place it into, look, I like the sport. I want to buy a brand new bike, you know, and, you know, I look at the first category of that, you know, so $500 to $1,000, you know, and then from $1,000 to $2,000, $3,000 upwards, right? You know, we certainly don't have to rush out and buy, you know, a $3,000 to $5,000 dual suspension, you know, awesome bike.
No, absolutely not. And actually, if somebody doesn't have experience mountain biking, or, you know, riding at higher speeds, those more expensive bikes are too much bike. Mm-hmm. The geometry on those bikes, you know, the angle that the fork sits at, the distance between the wheels, the reach to the handlebars, all those different geometries in the bike for the really expensive bikes, they're designed assuming that somebody getting on there has years of experience riding. And while they're capable of hitting, you know, very hard terrain very, very quickly, they can actually be pretty difficult for new riders to control. A lot of riders, when they get too much bike, they find that the bike tends to, I've heard people describe it as, it feels kind of twitchy, and it doesn't really want to hold up very well in the turns. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of people jump on these high-end bikes that aren't ready for it, and on tight turns, they tend to fall to the inside of the turn. They've got a lot of difficulty controlling those high-end bikes at low speeds. Because they're designed to just stay at high speeds. So I would absolutely say that if somebody's looking to get a bike that they want to maybe do a little bit of racing, they want to push themselves a little bit, there's no reason they need to spend more than $1,000 at all. I really think under $1,000 is the place somebody should be starting.
Yeah, for sure. And while we're here, we'll talk about briefly hardtail versus dual suspension.
Oh yeah. So full suspension is amazing. If you can afford it and get full suspension and you've been riding for a bit, that's the way to go for almost any scenario. The trouble with full suspension is, to make full suspension work well, you've got to throw a lot of money into the design of that system. When you're pushing down on the pedals, you're pushing weight down on the bike. As far as that shock knows, that's the exact same thing as the bike pushing up against you. And the cheap full suspension stuff is actually going to waste a lot of your pedaling power. I've seen some studies that show that really cheap full suspension bikes can waste about a third of your pedaling force just going into compressing that shock, bouncing that spring back and forth. Mm-hmm. The cheap full suspension bikes too actually control very poorly. There's no hydraulic dampening in that rear shock. So you go over a bump and your rear wheel is just bouncing up and down. You don't have solid contact with the ground, and it's a mess. So I would say full suspension is great, but I wouldn't touch full suspension bikes under about $1,500. Because they have to make so many compromises to get that bike under that price point that what little benefits remain of a full suspension bike at that point are really outweighed by all of the downsides for it. But hardtails are very, very capable. They're easier to maintain. They're better price. I really think anybody starting out should get a decent hardtail rather than a cheap full suspension.
For sure. And here in Australia, we often have very wide fire trails, and the cars can quite easily drive over them. They're not a lot of difficult terrain here in Australia as well. So another reason why for me a hardtail is more than adequate to race and be competitive here in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you go and you look at the top end races, mm-hmm. When I was racing in Sweden a couple of years ago at the World Championships, mm-hmm. I would say it was probably 90% hardtail. Mm-hmm. Not because the bikes were less expensive, but the little bit of weight savings with a hardtail, yeah. And that little bit of a boost in efficiency with a hardtail on smooth trails, mm-hmm. Just meant that hardtails actually were the better performing bike in those conditions.
It's just interesting, and we'll talk about different terrain and tracks very shortly, but it's really comes down to what's what you're riding on regularly, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So is there any sort of pitfalls or, what makes up a bad bike, dual bike? Is there anything sort of like big red flags that people, you want people to stay away from?
Yeah. So for one thing to avoid on bikes is just any bike that, originally retailed for less than $200 mm-hmm. Is not a bike that was ever really designed to be ridden regularly and at speed. Those bikes in that price range, they usually have lots of parts that are just made out of stamped metal that can be pressed together. Again, if you're just using it to ride around the neighborhood with kids, take on a camping trip now and then, sure, those bikes are fine for that. Yep. But I've seen bikes like that somebody goes over a curb at a moderate speed an axle can snap, the wheel can jam in place, and people can crash. So I would absolutely stay away from bikes that, even when they were new, weren't very good. Mm-hmm. Older bikes, even bikes from the 90s, there are some bikes in the 90s that were built well enough that they hold up to, you know, even to hard riding today.
Yeah.
So my first thing is, you know, don't ride hard on a bike that was never good to begin with. Mm-hmm. My second thing is, I really want to steer people away from mountain bikes that are older than about 3 years.
Okay.
The reason for that is there have actually been really big changes in how bikes are made in just the last few years. It's not to say that the older bikes aren't capable. There's mm-hmm. plenty of people riding bikes older than that that do just fine. But the newest bikes have geometries that actually serve bike joring really, really well. Mm-hmm. One thing that very new bikes have is a much more slack fork angle. So the fork, which connects the frame to the front wheel where you've got the suspension up front, mm-hmm. instead of being more vertical like it used to be, it's much more stretched out. Not as stretched out as like a chopper motorcycle, but a lot more stretched out. And what actually, and it was never designed for being good for bike joring, but a consequence of bikes having that slack front fork is that it actually gives the rider much more control over the front end of the bike. Before, with the forks that were really vertical, a bike running, you know, or a dog running to the side of the bike chasing a squirrel could really easily pull you down. The new bike geometries actually give you a lot more control over the front end of that bike. So the other thing that I would say is, you know, that you really should try and get the newer, more modern designs on bikes. If you're really trying to take this seriously,
for sure.
I would take a lower end, you know, I take a new $500 bike mm-hmm. over a bike that was $1,000 10 years ago.
Yeah, and just on that, a lot of the newer bikes as well, we'll talk about brakes, you know, so a lot of the new bikes have an upgraded disc brake system.
Yeah, so disc brakes are, again, they're absolutely fantastic. But one really tricky thing that's hard for, you know, the average person to see is that cheap disc brakes are actually worse than good rim brakes. If I went to Walmart, big department store a few weeks ago, and I was just looking at some of the bikes they had, and I noticed that a lot of them just had disc brakes on the front. And at first glance, that kind of made sense to me. You know, you usually want about 70 to 80% of your braking power to come out of your front wheel. So you want better brakes in the front. Yeah. And I started looking at these bikes more closely and I realized that these front disc brakes were just garbage. They were almost unusable. And I realized that the only reason the bike didn't have disc brakes in the rear is because if it didn't have rim brakes in the rear, that rider wouldn't have been able to stop. So I do want to caution people that, you know, it just because you see a bike that has disc brakes doesn't necessarily mean that's actually better than what you have right now. Now, that said, if you go into an actual bike shop, you know, a shop dedicated to selling bikes, mm-hmm. every bike that has disc brakes in that shop is going to be an upgrade over any rim brake bike in that shop. But again, those really cheap bikes that they're made to look really good. You know, they try and check all the boxes that people want to see, you know, oh, it's got shocks in the front and the rear. Oh, it's got disc brakes on it. Oh, it's got this. And it's unusable.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a big believer in shopping local and, you know, where I support, you know, my local bike shops, you know, no worries at all. And the power of being able to go in and really get a good fitting, you know, size, you know, the right bike for you is, for me, just, you know, rather than buying obviously direct on Amazon and the big department stores, is just that next level.
Yeah, absolutely. Your local bike shop, you know, the bike shop's employees, there's easier places to make that much money. Yeah. They're there because they love it. But what I've seen, you know, in all the years of working in shops, and especially as mail order bikes have become a lot more popular, mm-hmm. I've realized that mail order bikes are actually no better value than what you have in a bike shop. Mm-hmm. You might look at a bike online and be like, oh man, this has this $500 bike online has parts that, you know, that $1,000 bike in the bike shop has. This is a way better deal. Well, yeah, they put a few really nice parts on there, but they've cut corners on all the spots you can't see. You can't see online what kind of bearings it has. You can't see how that frame was made on that brand you've never heard of. Yep. And the truth is, if you buy $500 worth of bike anywhere, you get $500 worth of bike. Mm-hmm. I've never really seen any bike that's a ripoff. Mm-hmm. What I have seen is bikes that, you know, take big shortcuts to make other parts of the bike better. But yeah, it's a misconception that people think that online bikes are a better deal. They really aren't. They really aren't. When you look part by part and really get in there, they're actually not a better deal at all. Plus you get it. And, you know, when something goes wrong, you're good luck emailing somebody that you've never spoken to. Whereas if you take your bike back into a local bike shop, and things do break on bikes, it does happen. When you take it back into a local bike shop, they can, you know, they'll take care of it. So local bike shops are absolutely the way to go.
And you know, and just, you know, on that, you know, so, you know, we've got a number of big name brand bike shops here in my town, and it came down to, you know, very similar bikes, very similar price. It was a salesperson, you know, he was great for me. Yeah. So I don't, you know, we won't go right into brands, but, you know, between Norco, Specialized, Trek, Giant, you know, all these big name brands, the bikes and the geometry are very, very similar. They're similar parts. It was the sales guy, you know, who was nice, friendly, took the time, you know. So certainly I'm a big advocate for that.
Absolutely. I agree with that completely. All those brands are great bikes. I mean, it's really hard nowadays to go into a bike shop and find a bad bike. Mm-hmm. You know, bikes have gotten so good in the last few years. It's really hard to go wrong with it. Mm-hmm. And when the bikes are so similar for the price point, you're absolutely right. Find a shop where the people there are passionate and want to help you.
Yeah.
That's the best choice.
Yeah. And, you know, like just on a side note there, you know, my bike shop does road, you know, we go shop rides, you know, on the road, we do mountain bike ride skill sessions, you know, on the weekends, you know, so they're all free, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, oh, absolutely. You know, it's bike shops are also a great way to connect with your local riding community.
Yeah. For sure. So, you know, I'm definitely a big advocate for, you know, getting into a local bike shop if you can. Yeah, I suppose if you can is the disclaimer there that not everyone has a local shop close by.
No, and that's true.
So I said that, you know, that's a bit of a segue into, I know that we've touched on, you know, your philosophy in regards to buying, you know, bikes, you know, within sort of 3 years and things like that. What about used bikes? You know, there's obviously Facebook Marketplace here, Gumtree. I'm not sure of any of other, you know, what big marketplaces you have there in the States, you know, but, you know, buying a used bike, any sort of pitfalls or things to be mindful of there?
Yeah, so a lot of things with that. One is it's very hard to just look at a bike that's, you know, 5 or 6 years old. Mm-hmm. And really for a new person to take in what made that bike good, what didn't make that bike good. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be very tricky. You know, if you know somebody that is very bike knowledgeable, there's often a lot of times that person can help you find a good deal on a used bike. But it's a very difficult thing to navigate to find something that is a good used bike if it's, you know, a more than a few years old. What I've also seen a lot of times is where somebody will sell a used bike. In all honesty, you know, they're selling it. They think the bike's in good shape. They're being honest. They think they're selling it for a good price. That next person gets it. You know, something's a little bit off. They take it into a bike shop, and we find that, you know, the entire drivetrain is completely worn out. You know, it's about to break down, and now the cost to replace everything is more than if that person had just bought a new bike. So it is something to definitely be wary of. Also, right now, I think used bike prices are ridiculously inflated. It used to be a great way to go, but now every time I glance and I look at prices for used bikes, I hardly see anything that's actually worth it. And a lot of those things are bad risks. So I would really, you know, normally, you know, if we talked 2 years ago, I would say, yeah, you know, there's some safe ways to try and get, you know, used bikes and this and this and this. right now, the used bike market is a mess. And I would really advise against that, unless you know somebody who knows bikes well that can help you with that.
Yeah.
But I'd say, then again, you know, if the bike is less than 3 years old, if it looks like it has very little wear, yeah, that's probably safe at that point.
Yeah, for sure. So I wanted to, to move into sort of, we talk about, wheel sizes. Obviously, there's been a big push in the last, number of years for, say, 29ers versus, 27 and a halves. Are you riding 29 these days?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm riding 29, and I can't imagine I would ever ride 27.5.
Yeah.
I actually got to ride one of the very first 29 inch bikes. I was working in a bike shop in, would have been 2003, when Gary Fisher, company owned by Trek, came out with their first full line of 29 inch bikes. And so we got sent some from Trek to go out and demo these as shop employees, so we could help market and spread how great 29 inch bikes were. Yeah. And they were awful. They were absolutely awful. The geometries were all wrong. It was new. Nobody quite knew how to make a 29 inch bike.
Yep.
But 18 years down the line, they have really matured. Mm-hmm. They have really, really matured. I think for racing, for bike touring, there's very, very few times that I think somebody would want to go with the 27.5. Yep. The benefits of the 27.5 are often that sometimes you can get, a comparable 27.5 a little bit cheaper. The wheels are going to be a little bit stronger because the spokes aren't, the rim's not quite so far away from the hub. Yep. So it doesn't get bent up quite as easily. The 27.5s that are also called the 650Bs, they tend to handle a little bit better in really tight and twitchy and technical situations.
Yep.
They're a little bit easier to get up to speed and slow down. So they're better for some technical riding.
Yep.
But in my opinion, for bike touring, the 29er is a clear win.
Yeah.
That said, if all you can get right now is a 27.5, and it's still going to be an excellent bike for you. But the 29ers, while being a little bit heavier, they roll and hold their speed a little bit better as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so the Marlin 7 that I've got, I picked it up yesterday, literally, and it was pouring down rain last night. I'm like, oh, I'll give it a miss. But, jumping on that this morning, it's just so smooth. It just rides very, very nicely.
Oh, absolutely.
Other things that I wanted to have a quick chat about were, pedals, clip-ins, and also dropper posts. So there's, I suppose, two things I get asked quite a lot about. So I'd love for you to answer those, your opinion on those couple of things.
Yeah, I use both. I ride clipless pedals and I ride dropper posts.
Mm-hmm.
Clipless pedals, nobody should be starting on clipless pedals. Mm-hmm. Build the skills, get comfortable on the bike, figure out how to crash, as ridiculous as that sounds. Get better at crashing, and anybody who's gone through this knows exactly what I'm talking about, is that every time you crash, you can kind of pull it off a little bit cooler than the last time. you see new riders, they'll just be riding on the trail, and suddenly, like, the bike's flying one way, they're flying the other way into a cactus, and you're like, what, how did you do that? Then you see pro riders that, they just eat it. You're like, oh my God, we need to airlift this person out of here. And they stand back up and they're like, oh, I got a scratch. Get used to riding first. Once you get to that point, the benefits of clipless are great. One is that you don't slip off the pedals. That's my favorite reason to ride clipless pedals, is you don't slip off the pedals on the really rough and chattery stuff if you're just bombing down the trail. Clipless is also nicer in the climbs, that you can pull up a bit as you're pushing down. A lot of studies say that you can put about 20 to 25% more power down in a sprint. This is nice in a, in a race, especially, the sprint racing distance that these sports are. It lets you get off the start line a little bit faster, and it lets you pull out of the turns a little bit faster. So if you're really trying for the podium while bike touring, yeah, it's a good thing to do, but Give it a couple of years first before you go into that.
Definitely.
Unless you're feeling really confident.
There's some skills to be had there. Look, I'll confess, I have tumbled over many a times.
And you're glad nobody had a GoPro going?
I agree. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's been very funny. I'll be, all of a sudden I'll be upright and then I'll be on the ground.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, and so that's the thing is, you know, about all this, you know, just to kind of step aside for a second, is like, anybody who's doing bike touring, for every bike ride you do bike touring, you should go out and be probably doing two bike rides on your own. Like, you've got to build your own skills. Mm-hmm. You know, I see so many people at races. They show up, their dog's ready to go, they're charged, they're a fit person, they might be a strong runner, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, like I hope you survive this. Like, yeah. You know, I've seen some people get into some accidents in places that they really shouldn't if they had just had experience on the bike. So yeah, above everything else I'm saying today, practice on the bike. Yep. You know, work your skills without a dog, and that'll help you in situations where things go wrong.
For sure.
And that's the other thing with a dropper post too, is most racers don't use, you know, most of the top racers don't use dropper posts because there is a weight penalty to using a dropper post versus just like a straight carbon fiber post. Mm-hmm. I really like my dropper post. I use it in races. You know, darn the penalty. It lets me push the bike down a little bit harder in the turns. And it lets me have my feet flat on the ground while I'm at the start line, while I'm getting ready to go. And I like being able to do that. So many people, you know, put their bike seat down to a low level where they can kind of feel comfortable getting on and off the bike. Yep. But then the penalty for, you know, keeping the seat low is that you actually give up a lot of control of the bike. You can't really hold the bike under you very well. Your knees aren't in the right position to really put down power. So especially for newer riders, I think a dropper post belongs on most everybody's bike, touring bike. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure. And that's something you can retrofit as well.
And look, you know, they're two pedals and dropper posts were the first two things that went onto my new bike, you know?
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah, you know?
I think so too. I think a dropper post, everybody should put a dropper post on their bike, your bike, right away.
Yeah. So I just wanted to double back for a moment and, you know, something that I do, you know, building up. So we're in summer here at the moment. So we're just sort of relaxing, chilling out, you know, the dogs are being dogs. I'm coming up to Christmas. So, you know, food will be flowing. But I wanted to talk about, you know, building bike jaw fitness, you know, so, you know, you probably see behind me, I've got my road bike here behind me. So over the summer, I'll be out building my base on the road, you know. So, you know, I'll only probably do a couple of sessions, you know, on the bike on the trails. But most of it, while I'm trying to trim down and build my base, will be on the road bike, right? Is that something you do, or do you like to just ride? You know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh no, yeah. When it's summertime here, we do very little bike touring at all. We're up in the mountain, even though we're in Arizona, which most people think is really hot. We're actually in the mountains here. I mean, mm-hmm. We get our, you know, we only have like 3 months out of the year that don't have any freezes.
Yeah.
So it's cold here. So we actually do get down to temperatures we can run most of the time. But okay. In the summer, you know, I really just work on my own fitness, let the dogs run free, yeah. Keep them wet to keep them cool. But yeah, I think that goes for everybody doing these sports, is don't just think about the dog's fitness. Think about your own. It's a team sport, and you can be building your skills all year.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it's something that I'm a big fan of is, you know, we live here in Toowoomba, it's quite hilly, but I've, you know, find the local track and I just do laps, you know, just to build my fitness and get my leg, you know, leg strength and power happening as well.
Yeah, and it goes back to, you know, building, you know, I think people should be taking the same bike to our bike out and mountain biking with it. You know, mm-hmm. build your own skills.
Yep.
You know, that makes all the difference in races too. If you can go through a turn, you know, at a few miles or a few kilometers per hour faster, you know, that could be the difference of 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. You know, the last race I did, I think the top five racers we're all within like 8 seconds of each other. So yep. Yeah, build your own skills too. Be a good mountain biker.
Yeah, awesome. So, you know, I wanted to talk about single tracks. You know, we don't get them here very often. you know, like I said earlier, most of our are quite wide, you know, fire trails here. But I suppose, you know, we see it you know, if you watch any, you know, YouTube, you see the guys in Europe riding single tracks. And, you know, the biggest question, you know, I get asked is, you know, is that safe? And you know, how do we go about introducing ourselves to a single track?
I'm a huge fan of single track riding. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot of people say some very nasty things to me about this. But yeah, you look at some, you know, like Igor Trax and his friends in Europe. We've actually, there's some people I know up in French Canada that do single track bike touring. Mm-hmm. There are people here in the United States that do it. And a lot of them actually don't really tell people about it because there are some very, very opinionated people that say it is unsafe and you shouldn't be doing it. Mm-hmm. I think that if you have mountain bike skills and you've got a well-trained dog, there's absolutely no reason to not single track bike share with that dog. Mm-hmm. That's actually most of my training is single track bike touring. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. But I don't, it would be very dangerous for an inexperienced rider to be doing that. When you're going fast and your dog's out in front of you, you know, it's, if someone's coming fast around the corner the other way, you've got to have, you know, the confidence to be able to brake and avoid accidents. Mm-hmm. So yes, absolutely. I think single track bike touring is a wonderful thing. We're actually working with the one of the government owned lands in Utah up here, possibly planning a single track bike tour race this spring. But my general rule that I tell people is whatever level you can ride on a mountain bike, you can bike tour one level down from that. So if you're somebody who is riding black diamonds on a mountain bike very confidently, you're probably okay going bike touring on a blue, you know, intermediate trail below that.
Yeah, for sure. And I suppose that sort of leads into more a little bit about safety and, you know, in your, once again, in your opinion, items that are sort of undervalued or underutilized or underappreciated even in the bike, you know, in regards to safety kit.
Yeah, and see, the attitudes towards safety have changed a lot. Like even in the last, probably in the last 15 years, yeah. Attitudes on safety have changed a lot. I can't think of the last time I was out mountain biking and I saw somebody without a helmet. Yeah. And so, you know, it's the culture on it has changed completely. And it is, you know, the safety gear is really important. Crashes do happen. Yeah. Working in bike shops, you know, all the time we'd see people come in for crash replacement. Hey, I crashed and I cracked my helmet. And there's like, you know, a huge gash in their helmet. You know, just a giant scoop taken out of it where they hit some rock. Mm-hmm. And they're walking around just fine. So, I do see this. It's good that you bring this up because I do see some people coming in from that aren't mountain bikers. Mm-hmm. You know, they're taking that bike out of the garage that's been sitting there for a decade. And 10 years ago, nobody wore helmets. The culture around that has changed. Yep. So I think it's good to bring attention to those people who are getting into it that aren't coming from the mountain biking side to for know sure. that yeah, it really is expected that for everyone sure. does that.
And the other thing is, well, on that their helmet's 10 years old as well, right? Been sitting in the
yes.
you know, so they don't go out and buy a new helmet. They get the bike from the garage. The helmet's been sitting there for 10 years, and you know we know what helmets like were 10 years ago.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, not only have helmets improved a lot, but the older helmets, they do become brittle and can crack, especially if they're sitting somewhere hot for a while. Mm-hmm. But new helmets are lighter, they're more aerodynamic, they let the you know, the breeze into your hair to keep your head dry. They're really, really comfortable. The new helmets are comfortable, and they do so much better to protect you in a crash.
Sure. What about full faced helmets? You know, they've come a long way in regards to weight reduction as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I never thought I would wear a full face helmet, but actually I do grab my full face helmet quite a bit. If I'm running three dogs or more, like on my cart or sometimes in my mountain bike, I am running three dogs. Mm-hmm. I do grab my full face helmet. I've had a few crashes on my face mm-hmm. without a full face helmet that I wish I had had them for. But I've seen some people have some pretty awful crashes.
Yeah.
What's really cool, some of the newer full face helmets, you can actually remove the chin portion of the helmet. There's some clips on it. You take the helmet off, and in a few seconds, you can turn a full face helmet into a regular helmet for the slow riding, and then you change it back over to full face for the sketchy stuff.
Yeah.
I never thought I would be riding a full face helmet on cross country trails, but I do break it out for days that I know I'm pushing myself a bit, or I'm pushing my luck a little bit.
I was just looking at full face helmets yesterday, like a range of Fox helmets, and you know, here that there's a number they start at 200 and they go to 700-800, once again, just determining what's best for you and also within your budget as well.
There's good full face helmets for $100 too.
Yep.
You don't need to go that nuts. The higher end ones, they're going to be better vented, they're going to be more comfortable, they're going to be lighter weight. But, once you get to, generally once you get to like $70 for a helmet, the protection is the same from there up. They just get more comfortable. They get more durable. Mm-hmm. The styling is neater, but they do the same job.
Yeah, for sure. So it's something that I'll be looking at, going out in a full face helmet for the first time, So that's something.
Yeah.
I compare it to, an accident and a broken nose or a broken jaw.
Yeah. And one more thing that the main reason that I say above everything else that I ride a full face helmet is we live in a forested area, but it's all volcanic cinders. So we actually live 3 miles away from a dormant volcano. Yeah. And all the land around here is all just pea-sized gravel.
Yep.
And when you're going 20 miles an hour behind your dog, those bits of gravel are just slamming into my face all the time. So I often wear a full face helmet just to stop them from kicking rocks up at me.
Yeah. Fantastic. Goggles or glasses?
Oh, man, I go through so many glasses. They get scratched up. I actually go to welding supply stores.
Yeah,
this is actually a great gear tip. I go to welding supply stores where they actually sell just like those throwaway safety glasses that you hand to like a contractor on a job site.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get them for, $3 or $4.
Yeah.
I ride it for a couple of weeks and then it's so scratched up that I just toss it and grab a new one.
Yeah.
I've had some like $100 glasses that after a few rides, I'm like, I can't even use this for driving anymore. Buy the cheap glasses, go to a welding supply store, and just get the cheap ones and just keep a handful of them.
Yeah, no, awesome. Well, I have to wear, I wear glasses. So I've got, I've got safety, safety prescription glasses that were 400, they're $400 a go.
Oh man. Yeah. My wife has some prescription sports glasses and they're getting beat up so fast from rocks being thrown up.
Yeah, no, I've got two pairs and one of them is certainly on its last legs for sure. So we wanted to move into take a few moments to bring it to the fore, about race prep and what people need to really think about. They've got their bike and a couple of sort of either safety checks or maintenance checks that they really need to do on leading into competition. And obviously we're going to recommend a bike shop to go over it. It's been sitting in the garage for a number of years, but what sort of things would you be looking for?
If there's one thing that racers just need to do is just check their tire pressure. You wouldn't believe it how many people come to races with just dangerously low tire pressure in there, and it feels all right. It's not. Here in Arizona, where we have, we're known for cacti and thorns growing on every single plant here. Thorns aren't even the number one cause of plants here. It's under inflation of tires. People have low pressure, they hit a bump, the tube gets pinched and it tears the tube.
Yeah.
Even in the place where we've got more thorns than anywhere else in the world, under inflation of tires is the biggest thing. Okay. Or if the tire's underinflated, the tire can actually slip on the rim and rip the valve core off. And so that's the thing is if people could do one thing, it would be check their tire pressure and check it with a gauge regularly.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing to watch for on the bike. Everything else, if somebody's really inexperienced with their bike, the best thing to do really is just take it into a shop. But, I've never worked at a shop that somebody couldn't just wheel a bike in and be like, hey, I've got a race this weekend. Can you just make sure it's safe?
Mm-hmm.
I've never been in a shop that we even charge for that. Just to like, because a trained mechanic can be like, ah, sure, they'll walk over within 30 seconds or a minute. They can tell if the bike is okay to go. They may be like, yeah, it's safe. You should bring it back in for a tune-up when you get a chance. Mm-hmm. If there's something that really is gonna potentially lead to an accident on the race, an experienced mechanic can point that out right away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I really would, you know, a few days before the race, just wheel it into a shop and say, hey, can somebody have a quick look at this? Mm-hmm. I doubt the shop will even charge you, or if they do, it's going to be a fair price. Yeah. And again, if it's a shop that you bought the bike from and you've been buying stuff with them, if you have a relationship with that shop, no, they're not, I doubt they're going to charge you.
Yeah. Sure.
So, but the big thing though, on that is ask your shop what sort of spare parts you should carry. I carry a ton of spare parts for bikes that aren't even my own, because I know every race I go through, somebody breaks their bike and they're going to scratch. And I'm like, okay, bring your bike over here. And this is true for some of the other guys out here too. You know, some of the big riders, they all have their spare parts, and they've got spare parts for other people's bikes too. But don't rely on somebody else having the parts there. Sure, there's probably going to be somebody who knows how to fix your bike, but you know, carry spare tubes, carry you know, like an extra chain link, some extra cable and housing, whatever your shop recommends. You know, spend $30 or $40 to keep a kit of spare parts, even if you have no idea what to do with them. Your shop can hook you up with some spare stuff.
Yeah, for sure. You know, yeah, spare tubes, a pump, you know, like, you know, if it's a hand pump, it's a hand pump, you know, like, it doesn't matter, you know. Certainly, that's something that, Allen keys, you know, a small Allen keys, you know, that
having multiple tool with you. Again, even if you don't know what you're doing with it, you know, if you break down on the side of the trail and, you know, and you've got the stuff with you, somebody's probably going to come by that knows what to do. You know, I've been backpacking before, and I've come across cyclists that have like broken things in their bike. I don't have any bike stuff with me, but they've got the stuff. They're like, I don't know how to do any of this. I was sold this tool and I'm able to fix it on the spot. So yeah, just have the stuff with you.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, look, you know, we've been going for a little while now, Brad. Is there anything, we're going to sort of wrap things up a little bit, but is there anything else that you'd like to add before we get into where people can find you and things like that? So, you know, we've covered off quite a broad spectrum of, you know, especially for the beginner there, beginner bike draw, someone looking to get a new bike and, you know, things to look out for, et cetera. But yeah, is there anything else you'd love to add?
Group rides. Mm-hmm. The last thing I'd like to say is, you know, get a bike that you can afford, that's, you know, at least at a bike shop level. Mm-hmm. Anything a bike shop sells you will make it down the trail. Mm-hmm. And join group rides. You'll find people out there that are at the same level as you. You know, you'll find people that'll kind of push you a bit. You'll find people that'll, you know, kind of give you tips on that. More than anything else, people should go out and hang out with other mountain bikers to test their skills.
Yeah, for sure. No, I agree. I'm a big advocate of that. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, my local shop does a weekly ride. Sometimes they do it twice a week, you know, so that's a good introduction. And if they know you at the shop, you know, they're going to welcome you into their community quite easily as well, you know. So that's, I'm a big, you know, I love my local bike shop. So I know that you've got heaps of things happening coming up, but you know, got some races, things like that. Would you like to give us a bit of a rundown for anyone living in the States, what sort of events and things that you've got coming up?
Well, there's a couple little races, dryland races coming up. Yep. Everyone's starting to pull the sleds down from the attic, so we're starting to get snow here and there. Yep. On my drive home from work, you know, saw we had some, you know, got a few inches of snow up in the mountains above us today.
Yeah.
So winter's coming for that. Mm-hmm. You know, there are actually, again, one group I run on Facebook is Bike Drawing Western USA.
Yeah.
Come check us out there, especially if you're interested in a single track race. I think we've got a chance to kind of create a new sport and give it the respect that it needs.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. And anywhere else, I know that you've got your Facebook page under Dark Sky Racing Kennels as well on social media.
Yes, Dark Sky Racing Kennels. That's our little kennel here in Arizona.
Yeah, awesome. All right. So, so Brad, look, once again, I really thank you very much for your time. You know, I really appreciate it. I'm hoping that people can take some little gems away from our chat today and really increase their knowledge or their, you know, their education around, you know, bike drawing and in particular, getting the right bike for them. So thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for you or a friend that loves dogs and fitness? Dogs and Deadlifts has you covered with merchandise and giftware, including t-shirts, hoodies, cushion covers, mugs, plus much more. Head over to teespring.com/dogsanddeadlifts. That's teespring.com/dogsanddeadlifts. Or check out the link in the podcast notes.